Ben Affleck is actor, screenwriter, director, and a founder of the Eastern Congo Initiative, a U.S.-based advocacy and grant-making initiative focused on Eastern Congo. Mr. Affleck, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, if ever there was a mess in this world, it was Eastern Congo. I mean, warlords, child soldiers, mayhem. What was it about what you found in your early visits to that region that persuaded you that there was anything that could be done to heal people there, to heal the economy there?
Well, I saw sort of both of the things that you're talking about. The first time I went there, I was just struck by the surface brutality. You know, they had had 5 million people die of conflict and conflict-related causes like starvation and disease. The average lifespan was, I think, 47. It was racked by a number of ongoing wars. 1 in 5 children died before the age of 5. I mean, there was a litany of statistics that was just horrendous. And I was struck by the fact that during the time that I started researching it, you know, Darfur had gotten a lot of attention, which, of course, it merited. But, you know, people had barely heard of what was going on in Congo, and it was one of the most brutal wars in the world, if not the most. When I visited and when we started going down there, you know, part of it was because no one was going there. We wanted at first just to demonstrate that it was possible to work there. And then I was really struck by the fact that the people who were living there were not, you know, hiding under tables. They were not cowering before warlords. You could go to a city and people were still going to work and trying to sell cell phone chips and bananas and these little scooters, and that the human spirit was such that people wanted not only to live but to thrive and to succeed. In fact, the very same things that we believe in fervently here, sort of the American dream. The Congolese had a similar dream, and I was really moved by that. You know, I had sort of, I guess, subconsciously labored under this delusion that is fostered here when we see images of Africans, you know, swollen bellies, lying on their back, flies in their eyes, helpless, that sort of thing, waiting for a handout. And these were people who, in particular, the community-based organizations that I was drawn to, who were doing that work for themselves in an extremely smart and dedicated way.
You know, a key word here, I think, is regenerating society and regenerating the economy of Eastern Congo. But what do you think the biggest barrier is to that? And, you know, what can you do to get past the barriers?
Well, that's what we're trying to address. I mean, Congo has enough arable land to feed a third of the world's population, okay? I mean, it's staggering. Wow. So the second biggest rainforest in the world, only 2% of that is actually being farmed. When we looked at aid and traditional aid and aid models and what was successful, we found really a mixed bag. In fact, opponents of aid will point out that $50 billion has been given over the last 70 years and there hasn't been much progress. Part of what we believed was that that was because in large measure it was about Western people paying themselves to go over there and sort of wander around and do various short-term projects. So we wanted to do something sustainable that would raise incomes and that would be there long after we were gone. And so what we chose was coffee and cocoa, both of which the Congolese, you know, were huge businesses and huge agricultural sources of revenue before the war, and which now had been totally eviscerated by war, by militia, by all sorts of things. People talk about the minerals, but really the great wealth is in the coffee and the cocoa. So what we did was, you know, we worked with, on the coffee side, about 4,000 farmers now, on the cocoa side, around 1,000. And what we did is build capacity, is say to them, hey, look, we went to these collectives and said, we know that this is what you're trying to do. What you need to be able to do is make slightly better products so that it can be traded on the open market. And when we did that and we brought in partners like, you know, Joe Winnie, for example, who said, Theo Chocolate is his company, who said, I will buy this if it meets these standards and I will help build capacity with this project. It worked quite well. And Theo has since, you know, they started by buying 28 tons. This year they've purchased 700 tons of cocoa, which is enough to make 10 million chocolate bars. And I know there are people who think they can eat that much in a day, but it's actually really substantial. And we could evaporate. And they're now in the marketplace. This is trade. It isn't aid. It's helping them get into a marketplace where it can be successful.
And it's a good market. I mean, we're hearing predictions of a cocoa and chocolate shortage in the years to come. And so presumably, this is a market that will be expanding for people in Eastern Congo.
I think so, and its agricultural conditions are prime for this kind of production. And one of the other things that we've done is leverage our position to do public-private partnerships. So, you know, on the coffee side, we brought in USAID and our friend Howard Buffett, who's spectacular, to work with these three cooperatives, 4,000 coffee farmers, And, you know, Starbucks just made their very first purchase of Congolese coffee, 40 tons. You know, that's 2.5 million cups of coffee. It arrived in Seattle last week. Those are the kinds of efforts that we think will bear long-term fruit. We also make all sorts of grants to community-based organizations, but we see that creating wealth, that creating jobs for people is the most potent way to achieve change.
By the way, you mentioned Howard Buffett. He's one of Warren's boys, right?
That's right. He's Warren's son. He's got an excellent family of dedicated philanthropists.
How do you avoid being the guy from California who thinks he's got the prescription for fixing problems, you know, half a world away?
Well, that's the very sort of root and nature of our organization, which is that we don't go in and dictate terms. We don't go in and say, this is how you do it. One of the flaws that we identified when I first started traveling and doing research was that you have large NGOs who sort of plant themselves in the region and say, this is how you're going to do it. And I kind of liken it to as if the Chinese showed up in Iowa and said, no, this is how you're going to farm. They may have a good technique for farming, but the cultural issues and the dramatic change would be such that it would be, I think, counterproductive. And so what we do is we identify the community organizations who are already in the communities, who already have the relationships, who are already leaders in the communities, who have experience with what they're doing, and we help foster growth with them. We help support them. We expand what they can do. And then, you know, we have a place that we fund who does works with child soldiers who've come out of militias and helps get them jobs, train them for jobs. And one of the things that we financed was a survey so that they could find out what jobs were actually out there in the marketplace that we could train them for. So we have all kinds of ways that we assist, that we help people who are doing great work, who don't have the funds and don't have the relationships, but we don't come down there and tell people what to do. I'm keenly aware of the fact that I am a guy from California, that despite the fact that I've been to the region 9 times and done a lot of research and know a lot of people down there, that doesn't make me an expert. What makes me smart is that I listen to experts, and most of all, I listen to the Congolese.
One of my reporters, his name is Sabri Benishore, was just in Eastern Congo. We've been hearing some of his pieces, yeah. And he found people working very hard to improve their situations. But you know what comes up time and time again? He told me corruption, money doesn't get to its intended destination. How much do you worry that your money and the money of your donors ends up in the wrong pockets?
Well, we've been criticized, frankly. There are now other, now that the war has abated and people have entered the space like us, we've been followed by others. And one of the things that we've been criticized for is being too rigorous around grantees, having them fill out, you know, number of forms, really have, you know, we have an office in Goma. Most of our employees are Congolese. So they'll go out there and visit the sites and ask questions, not just of the leaders, but of the people who are working there. And we put people through a very, very rigorous process for precisely this reason. And we think there's a higher bar because I'm a sort of target. You know, people like to pillory celebrities, particularly around this issue. And one of the things that we, you know, it's true that there is corruption in, for example, in the military, which is a real problem. I mean, a lot of soldiers aren't getting paid. And so what they do and what the tradition has been since Mobutu is to sort of live off the population, which is why 40% of the rapes are committed by the military, which is why there's been a lot of looting and why the reform of the security sector is so important. And what we do with that, because we're an advocacy and grant-making organization, is that we try to lever the U.S. foreign policy side into putting pressure on Kabila and others to reform the military, because that's not something you can do with community-based organizations. That's really a systemic issue. And the corruption stems from, you know, the destruction wreaked on the place by the Belgians and the subsequent corruption of Mobutu.
You know, before we go, I didn't ask you this earlier. What was the catalyst for you going to Eastern Congo for the first time? I mean, there's a lot of things wrong with the world. You chose this one. What was the initial spark?
Well, as I said, I initially Saved Darfur was a big movement, you know, around the time that I started looking at this, and I was asked to do a couple of things for them. And
for
I
Darfur,
thought they were
right.
Really great, for Darfur. And I thought they were a great organization, but they had a lot of celebrities sort of shining lights on that. And there was, and as I was reading, I came across a sentence in a book that said, you know, this 250,000 people have died in Darfur, and this is terrible. Of course, it pales in comparison to the 4 million who have died in Congo. And I was like, 4 million? I mean, that approaches the levels of the Holocaust. And I never had heard about this. And I was just astonished at the brutality, at the death, and at the fact that I didn't even know about it. So I traveled there, and I traveled into the whole sort of conflict matrix. You know, I went to South Sudan and Rwanda and Burundi and Uganda and the Republic of Congo and Tanzania and looked at what was happening there. And, you know, when I was in Congo and Eastern Congo in particular, I thought, this is the most devastated place in the world. This is the place in the world that most needs help, where no one can make an argument that a nickel is wasted, you know, where truly lives are at stake every single day, and that it's morally incumbent on us, on anyone, any human being, to assist, you know, our brothers or our sisters who are suffering in this way. And so to me, I want to go somewhere where I would never have any doubt that what I was doing was urgently needed. Whether or not I did the right thing is another question. But I felt that there was no debate about the degree to which the community folks in Congo required assistance.
Ben Affleck is a founder of the Eastern Congo Initiative, an advocacy and grant-making group. Yes, the same Ben Affleck who works in the movies. Mr. Affleck, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.